Good morning. The last of our series of This Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Our guest is the nation's finest sports broadcaster, Bruce McAvaney. And it's a great pleasure to say a very good morning to a very special guest. It's Bruce McAvaney. Good morning to you, Bruce.
Thanks for the intro, Brian. Yeah, great to chat to you, mate.
Look, I said special. I didn't mean it.
Well, I've known for that, obviously, and I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I could have said worse words, I guess. So every now and then it's I have a smile. We get stuck with these things a bit, Bea.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't worry too much about it because you're a special broadcaster. You've been at the top of your game for, arguably the last 20 to 25 years, and what stands you alone is the fact that you you embrace any sport with such a great fervour. How you do it, your research, astounds everyone. And you've got to tell us a little bit about that as we roll along. But what I'd love to talk to you about is the connection with racing. And I know you come through through Adelaide, and you talked about going to the races with your dad to the birthday cup at Victoria Park on the 26th of March 1966, and you saw a great horse.
Look, you're well versed, because it's true, and the horse was Galilee, and that does stick in my memory. He'd won the City Handicap the week before, and it was a double at Victoria Park Racecourse, and you know that course well, having called in Adelaide. And so it was a City Handicap Birthday Cup, and Dad said to me after he won the Birthday Cup, he said, well, you've just seen the Melbourne Cup winner, and it was pretty exciting for a kid. You know, I wasn't quite 13 at the time, and I can remember it vividly, and of course the horse went on, and unfortunately, BMI, I was a huge Lightfingers fan at the time, and Galilee won and she ran second that year. But my father backed him in the Caulfield Cup. Tobin Bronze, another South Australian, was a sure price favourite, and the Melbourne Cup. And we were battlers, didn't have much, and Dad was able to build a garage, or get a garage built and put his car undercover because of Galilee. So it was a big thing for us at the time. It really was.
That's a good story. 14-1 in the Caulfield Cup, and he got in with 54. He'd won the Toorak Handicap the week before. This is 1966. And, of course, he got beaten and under sort of controversial circumstances in the McKinnon. And then that devastating win in the Melbourne Cup. He was just far too good for Lightfingers. So it was a brilliant win. And Bart has always said of the great, like the legion of champions that he's had down through the years, that I think Galilee sits up there at about number one or two.
I think so, Brian. And, look, you know, as we get older, and you're in a similar position to me, you do have a lot of nostalgia, and you're very affectionate towards those early champions. And for me, he's in my three or four favourite all-time horses. And I think at 2 miles, he was probably just about as good. Things have changed. I mean, you'll see a Protectionist, a Delta Blues, those types of horses, American, and Maccabi Diva, of course. But I think Galilee, for his time, was as good as I've seen at 2 miles. He went on, of course, and won the Sydney Cup the next year in the same season, quite remarkably. So, loved him. Very fond of him still. And, you know, Bart's had all these great horses, and I would have thought that if he wasn't his best, he's close enough to it.
Growing up in a working suburb at Woodville over there in Adelaide, going to the races for the first time, and I believe it might have been when you were 6 years of age. Do you remember going to the races with Mum and Dad then?
Look, my absolute first memory, and they probably took me when I was even earlier than that, my absolute first memory was a derby in Adelaide where Jordan was the favourite, and Stormy Passage, I should have looked this up, Stormy Passage won the race. I think I'm right in saying this, and I'm pretty sure that's Bart Cummings, the very first Group 1 winner he ever had.
Yeah, it was 1958, his first Group 1.
Okay, well, yeah. I was born in 1953, so I would have been five, and that because our derby in those days, like the Sydney Derby, was in the spring, prior to the Melbourne Derby. So I can remember distinctly that day at Moffatville. We went to Cheltenham a lot. Cheltenham was our local track. So, yeah, from that age. And for me, probably growing up, the really big races were the Christmas Handicap and the Port Adelaide Cup, because it was around the corner from where we lived, and they were big races. You remember them in Adelaide. So, yeah, my first memory probably is that SA Derby, Jordan the favourite, and little did I know that I was witnessing, and can't remember, but I was witnessing the first of whatever. How many has he got? 268 Group 1?
Something like that, yeah.
It's not bad, is it?
he is just phenomenal. There's no other question for him.
Just on that, I mean, and growing up in Adelaide in the 1960s, because I was born in 1953, it was a pretty remarkable time. We had Bart Cummings, Colin Hayes, Graham Higney, and we had horses like Galilee and Light Fingers and Rain Lover and Tobin Bronze. Get 'em, of course, won in 63, but it was the golden era. It was our absolute golden era. I would back South Australia through that decade of the 60s to have been the number one state in terms of big horses and big races won. Now, it's probably the only time in the history of racing you could say that about South Australia. So for me growing up and getting into my teenage years, it was quite influential and had a huge impact on me.
Even going back to Bart's dad, Jim Cummings, and the great Comic Court, you know, a horse that could win run a record in a Melbourne Cup and then resume in the William Reid on Australia Day at Moonee Valley, 6 furlongs less 20 yards, and break the track record. Like, a phenomenal horse.
Yeah, that story my father told me numerous times growing up, about that very same horse. And just that record that you talked about, the fact that he was able to break the record in the Melbourne Cup and then do the same thing first up in the William Reid. So part of the legend, and, you know, the Cummings family have had a huge imprint in Australian racing, and in particular here. I mean, Bart's brother, Pat, my father worked with at the taxation department. And Pat was a big breeder, a big punter, as you know, a Storm Queen, Storm Rule of those horses. And, they were magic times.
And you spoke about the legendary trainers and the jockeys, the Billy Pyers and the Pat Glennon and the Jimmy Johnson and the, you know, guys like the Laddie Is, Johnny Letts and Johnny Stocker and Noel Mifflin. And those guys would come to Melbourne and they could be competitive anywhere in Australia, but worldwide.
Well, Glennon's got this remarkable record, having won a Derby, an Arc, and a Melbourne Cup, which I think Michael Canaan equaled, and I'm not sure how many jockeys have got it now. So you had Glennon, Pye, as you mentioned, Ginger Meggs. I got to know Billy a bit, and look, he was just a larger than life character, an incredible guy. And Keith Hillier, you know, tells some great stories about Billy, and you know, Johnny Letts, who I know you're so close to, and he sort of followed those guys, Johnny Stock, etc. So, look, it was a good time to be born in Adelaide and love horse racing, because we had stars, whether they be horses, trainers, or jockeys. So, and you, I can't remember exactly, Brian. Did you come over in the 70s? Was it? Or
yes, I went to. I started in Adelaide in 1970. I was there for just on 2 years, and I actually left Adelaide on Adelaide Cup Day to come back to start at 3 years.
Okay,
so I had 2 years there.
It, weren't you? But you racing was strong here, and
yes,
we had a lot of big players in Australian racing. So it had a huge influence on my thinking.
Do you remember Cardigan Bay, 63 Inter Dominion?
I remember the night well. I wasn't at the race at the trot. Idle Raider fell over at the concrete stand. I was at my father and mother, and I and my brother and sister were at Charlie Walsh's place. Now, Charlie Walsh was a famous Australian cycling coach, and they lived across the road from us. And we went to Charlie's that night and listened to the race. And it was a massive event. And those Inter Dominions were huge. Richmond Lass was probably the first one I really remember properly. She I think was about 68, and so again, funnily enough, BM, we South Australian harness racing struggling, but there was a final, I think, in 69 or 70 in Melbourne where there were 9 runners and we had 5 of them from South Australia. Bold David led. He led, and we had Adios Court and Deep Court and Bylaw and Bon Adios and Moonstone Bay. I think they were the 5. I could be wrong, but, you know, it was a great time. So, yeah, going back to your question, you're cutting him, but I remember the night well, and he, of course, became this incredible horse that went to America and won $1 million and had these duels with Brett Hanover. So he was an amazing horse.
We're talking about the Wavell Showgrounds, and I remember calling there probably a dozen times in my time, and it was the tightest circuit. You know, we thought the showgrounds here in Melbourne was tight, but it was tighter, you know, so it was impossible for horses.
So the showgrounds was 3 furlongs, which is 600 metres, and Wavell was 2.5 furlongs. Just a very quick story. We went there so often, but the most memorable, and we saw, you know, they used to pack the place out, didn't they? I mean, it was a Colosseum. You know, it was like the Roman Colosseum. But probably my favourite night ever, Brian, was my mother took a Quinella on the first race one night. It was 4 and 11 with the numbers. It was in Charming Boy and Fiery Demon, and it came up. It was two and sixpence, and I paid £89. And she never, so she didn't leave the grandstand for the rest of the night, and gave us all some money. And I waited until the last race to have a bet, and I backed the horse that ran second, and I put 10 shillings on it. For me, at the time, was illegal,
bet,
but also
yeah.
a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
And we went out into the car park afterwards, and we were bragging to my dad's cousin about mum having won £89, and he was a big punter, and he'd had £100 on the winner of the last. So it was a big night. We went home and celebrated, and mum bought a washing machine and a vacuum cleaner. So that was our favourite night at Wavell. So you can see the impact it had on our lives, because it just made a difference when you had a winner. It was just great.
Yeah, well, you're getting everything sort of done around the house. You've got the garage sort of built in 66, and earlier mum's got the washing machine.
Well, I tell you,
yeah.
My father and I have got one thing in common. We've never been very useful around the house, so it's about all that happened, I can tell you.
And, Bruce, when were you sort of touched by the broadcast bug? Most of us go back and say, well, look, I can remember the Melbourne Cup of 1956 and listening to the race in the lounge room with mum and dad and thinking, where has that come from? You know, where's the man in the little Bakelite box? This crystal clear description coming from Flemington. And that's the spark that ignited the flame in me, I'm sure.
Yeah, look, and for me, it was listening to Bill Collins, I think,
yes.
mainly. Living in Adelaide, but we'd get Bill's calls. And I think... You know, I just wanted to be him. You know, I just couldn't believe how good he was. And there were those early Melbourne Cups for me. Probably the first Melbourne Cup for me was the centenary one with the famous finish with Hijinks getting up to beat Howes near Lump. You know, the three New Zealanders. How ironic, you know, in our centenary Melbourne Cup, New Zealand 1-2-3. But
and Tarek running seventh. Yeah.
Yes, and controversially,
yeah,
I mean, extraordinarily.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
Talked to Billy Pies about that day, and you know, he'll tell you a story about following Neville Selwood, but I better be careful there. But so probably that was my first one. And then, so from that early age, and look, Bill, through those 60s, you know, the Lightfingers, Zima call was famous, you know, dead heat in the Melbourne Cup, and those sorts of things. So, yeah, like you, sparked early, and it was a passion and a dream, and yeah, so I wanted to call the Melbourne Cup as a kid, and I wanted to be a broadcaster, but more than anything, I wanted to be Bill Collins. So it's quite strange, isn't it? So that's really what happened for me.
Well, you picked the right star to follow. And it was interesting, when I went to Adelaide between 70 and 72, I wasn't aware of Bert Day, and I didn't know much about Des Hoisted, because I'd sort of come through, you know, listening growing up to the 3UZ family and Bert Bryant and Ken Howard and people like that. So when I went over there and discovered 5AD... then I knew more probably about Bill Collins when I'd left Melbourne.
Yeah, he was a huge star here in Adelaide, and he was, we heard him all the time. And, you know, you mentioned Bert Bryant there, because I was the opposite. Bert Bryant and Ken Howard were foreign to me in a way. I mean, I knew their names, but I was Des Hoisted and Bill and Bert Day. So that's who I grew up with. And it's only recently, Bryant, and I've really come to appreciate Bert Bryant fully, I think, because... I've had a chance over the years, you know, they replay races, and what a wonderful caller, and what a, you know, incredible personality, and that's so different to Bill. And look, you know, we've all got our, you know, our favourites, and Bill will always be mine, but I can see why Bert was a legend. He was a superb caller and such an entertainer. And, you know, to have the two of them at the same time was pretty remarkable, I think, don't you?
Oh, yeah, we were spoiled. We're taking a break. We're spending time this racing life, and it's been a fabulous life so far. It's not over yet for Bruce McAvaney. We're talking with Bruce McAvaney this morning. It's an absolute pleasure to be chatting with you, particularly about those times and growing up in Adelaide. And I think we were on a bit of a parallel, because my first meeting was grand final day, Bruce, 1970, and I called a meeting at Mindery Hallerton.
Well, BM, we are, because 6 years later I was doing something similar, same day and at the same course. So that was really my first go. It was pretty basic, wasn't it, mate? I don't know. What was it like in 1970? Because I think I was on the back of a semi-trailer or something or other calling. I can't remember exactly.
Same here. Yeah, the back of a semi-trailer was the broadcast sort of position, and I didn't have a car. I was 20, and I got a lift with the stewards. They left at sort of 5:45 in the morning, and all the little hats were sitting on the back bench in the back seat. I can remember that vividly. But I did back a winner. I did back a winner there, and I think the course broadcast fee was $20, and it was a fortune at the time.
Look, great days. and look, that was that was the first time I really called him. The first time on radio for me was at Oakbank, which was a behind the hill job for me. Yeah. I think Pepsi was with Ron and Ray Fewingson on Peps, and I think one of them was on holidays, which was remarkable that they let them go on holidays, to be honest, at Easter time because of the dual yes. calling. And I got a chance behind the hill, and Brian, it was the biggest thing of my life, really. I mean, I can remember, couldn't sleep the night before, and all those things that go through your head. But you look back on it now, and really, I could have said anything. There was no TV, and I started a lot of the races at the back, and you know, I could have got away with anything, I reckon.
I think we did, and I was thrilled to be in that position too, because it meant Mum and Dad could hear me back in Melbourne.
Exactly, they were big meetings, weren't they?
Oh, massive. You went to 5DN. The story goes that you used to come across to the Kilmore Cup, the Pacing Cup, and you remember seeing that great horse Pure Steel in the Cup at Kilmore in 76.
Look, you reminded me of so much.
I knew I was going to be talking to you, Bruce.
Well, those Kilmore Cups were huge. And that was one day that, you wouldn't miss. They were just great meetings, loved them. And we used to come across these big trotting meetings as much as we could, but that was pretty special, to be honest. And it's still a great race. It's still a great race. And you know, in harness racing, you see some great horses, and Pure Steel, in terms of a stayer. I mean, he came to Adelaide as a young horse in the Inter Dominion and drew the wrong barrier in the final when Carclew headed them all off. But he was an amazing stayer. And again, WA had those great horses a little later with Persia Valier and Village Kid. But BMI was actually lucky enough to have called Popular Arms Derby in Adelaide when Gamelite beat him, and Poppy missed the kick. And
fabulous race. Yeah.
It was quite extraordinary, and we've seen some beauties. And look, harness racing, I still love, to be honest. I don't get a chance to watch it like I used to. I try and watch the big races. So it's a sport that I think's got some challenges in front of it. But I still think when you see a big harness race and see a great harness race, it does stir you.
Remember the ABC on a Friday night used to telecast, probably back in the black and white days too, the Miracle Mile from Harold Park.
Absolutely.
Massive meeting, massive.
Absolutely, and it was, Robin Dundee, I think, won the first of them, and there was a whole group of horses, so we are going down memory lane, but these are the things that influence you and shape you and make you, I guess, make you the person you end up being, and that's why, racing's my first love, and probably when I do retire, it'll be, of all the sports that I cover, and I'm lucky, you touched on it earlier, it's probably the one that I'm going to follow the closest until the day I'm not here, to be honest, because that very first love is a hard one to break.
That's extraordinary to hear you say that, because is it now eight Olympic Games that you've covered?
Eight summers, it is. So, and that's a long time. That's 1984 all the way through. And they are incredible events, Brian. And they're a great challenge. And to call athletics, which is to me is the sport of the Olympics. I mean, the Olympics is made up of 40 odd sports, and they're all great in their own right. But I love it. And so, singularly, if you said to me, how do you rate them? I mean, that 100 metres at the Olympics, or the Olympics are very high. But I think when I don't call anymore, I'll probably be racing or probably dominate my interests, I think.
Yeah, I was talking to Carolyn Searcy from Sky Channel during the week, and I said, I'll be talking to Bruce this Saturday. And she said, I've still got beta tapes with Bruce calling the greyhounds at Angle Park.
Well, all that says is that I'm darn old, unfortunately.
We all are.
But, Angle Park Dogs. So it's a good, great grounding, isn't it? I mean, that's the way we're the same vintage, really, you and I. And so we went through similar things to where we are now.
And I was there, calling in Adelaide when Globe Derby opened. It was a day, there were no lights. And it was such a big deal. They'd moved from Wavell to Globe Derby to the showplace out there, the harness track, such a big track. And Reg Norman and the Normans and the Websters, they were just so dominant. And their horses just looked brilliant. They'd be brilliant out of the gate. They'd be brilliant off the stand. And they were the impressionable years. And as you say, and that sort of probably unbeknown to us at the time, was guiding us to where, maybe our path was going to go and where we might finish up 30 or 40 years later.
No, for sure. Absolutely. No doubt about that. I mean, those anecdotal stories you hear as a kid, and it's the same with the Olympics. You know, my interest in the Olympics was something similar, hearing stories about Dawn Fraser and Betty Cuthbert and those people, and Marjorie Jackson and John Landy. So all of that and Herb Elliott growing up, because they were in the 50s and 60s, a bit of the same time as those horses I was talking about, and footy as well, and the cricketers. So, yeah, look, you're an impressionable age, and it shapes the way you're going to turn out to be.
Through radio, through Adelaide, through 5DN, then the sports reports on ADS Channel 7, a weekly racetrack show on Channel 7. You were able to produce that and be a part of that. And then the move to Melbourne. And the move to Melbourne was with Channel 10. That was sort of the mid-'80s.
Yeah, look, the end of 83, and it was really because of the Olympics, had a chance to call in Los Angeles. And it was a big decision, hard to leave Adelaide, but it was the right one, as it turned out. So I went to Channel 10. I was there for 6 years, a couple of Olympics, Melbourne Cups, great time, loved it. And then had an opportunity to go back to 7 through Gary Fenton and Gordon Bennett and the Olympics. And so went to Melbourne, spent 16 years in Melbourne, and fantastic years, and you know, it was obviously gave me a lot of opportunities and changed, I guess, my career, to be honest.
I love this call. It's the Melbourne Cup of 1986, and it's at Talak. It was Colin Hayes, who you obviously were very close to through South Australia, and he's a dear friend and a great mentor to so many people, not just, you know, trainers and jockeys, but to those that have the same passion and the love of racing. Let's roll back to Flemington. This is Bruce, a young Bruce McAvaney for Channel 10 and the Melbourne Cup.
At Talak, about to come at them from My Tristram's Girl, Mintmaster, Joel with a run. Empire Rose, Mr. Lamonti, Born to be Queen, running on in reckless tradition. At Talak at the 300th, burst away from Rising Fear. Two links to Sea Legend, further back, Joel, Mr. Lamonti, Kiwi with a late run. At Talak in front from Rising Fear. Kiwi running on the Sea Legend. Clark's got a one, I think. At Talak's a leap for a half in front of Rising Fear. Colin Hayes wins his second cup. At Talak, a half Rising Fear. Third Sea Legend, Kiwi.
Well, there he was at Talak. Michael Clark, always on the pace. Great fighting win. Must have given you a terrific buzz, Bruce.
It did, Brian, because that friendship with Colin, I grew up sort of, I guess idolising mightn't be quite, but respecting him so much.
Yes.
And you know him, you knew him, and the whole family. They're a wonderful family, the Hayes family. So, and I always felt he deserved at least two Melbourne Cups, and that was his second. He got them both with imported horses, and our great friend had ridden the other one for him, of course, Beldale Ball, Johnny Aletz.
Yeah.
But, it was a great day, and Michael Clark was at the height of his powers. He was a terrific horse. I think he'd been fourth in the English Derby and a top-class weight for age horse, and then he had that memorable race with Bone Crusher, of course, in the autumn. So it was a big day. I went up to the stables after the telecast to do a cross into the news, and it's one of those I'll never forget, Brian.
Yeah, yes, and he was Colin Hayes. He was a game changer, wasn't he? Changed so many things in racing, and racing benefits now from it. He was one of the greats. You know, when you think that we've come through a lifetime of Bart Cummings, T.J. Smith, and C.S. Hayes, doesn't really get much better than that, does it?
Amazing. And again, we talked about Bert Bryan and Bill being together, those three being together, and very different BM. I mean, the three of them are very different personalities, went about it in a totally different way. And CS, I guess, was a bigger breeder than the other two, but yeah, the other two are breeders as well. No, though, incredible. I mean, three of the biggest figures in world racing, let alone Australian, all together and going side by side. So, yeah, a remarkable time.
And Bruce, when we talk about Bill Collins, we talk about the call of Kingston Town can't win in the Cox Plate. You as a broadcaster, me as a broadcaster, and anyone with a reasonable eye to watching a race and watching a race unfold, what Bill said at the time was absolutely right. Kingston Town was going nowhere. He was going backwards.
Spot on. I mean, it was a brilliant call because the accurate one, and that's what he was that day. And then, of course, he picked it up, and then his finale was, I get goosebumps when I hear it. It actually makes me want to cry, to be truthful. That's ridiculous, but it's so, I get very emotional when I hear that race. And, because Bill, down the Kingston Town can't win, and then you can hear the voice change because he just might, and then he does. And
he still might get up the champ, as he said.
Yeah, and he did. And that whole day, BM, I mean... Manicato, the million, and I think Triumphal March, the favourite, won the Mooney Valley Cup. But it was just an incredible day's racing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And Les Carline, the doyen of writers, just got it word perfect when he said Kingston Town clawed the ground. And it was a beautiful term, wasn't it?
Well, he's right. I mean, and as you say, I mean, he's remarkable, Les, and that's what he did do. He was an amazing horse, one of the inaugural inductees into the Hall of Fame. Yes. I know you've been heavily involved in that over the years, and worthy. I mean, one of the basically unbeatable in Sydney. Once he, you know, had the bad run, gelded, unbeatable really in Sydney. And it's a shame he didn't win that Melbourne Cup, but he was an incredible horse. And three Cox Plate. There's some great records in Australian racing. There's Maccabi Divas 3. There's, I reckon, Rising Fast having won the three in the 1 year. There's Kingston Town's three Cox Plates, and there's Farlap's four wins on 4 days of the Cup Carnival. To me, they're the four that I love, and Kingston Town's part of that foursome, because I don't think it'll ever be better at BM. It may be equaled. I mean, so you think had he stayed here, probably he had a good chance of equaling it. But I don't think we'll ever see a horse win four Cox Plates.
No.
He's going to be there forever, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt. And so he should. So he should, because he's part of the folklore, and that's the beautiful part of the racing game that we're intoxicated by. So you would have been there calling for Channel 10, and you would have called the Bone Crusher Our Waverley Star, 86 Epic, the Cox Plate.
I did, and that was for Channel 10's news, and that was an amazing day. The build-up was huge because we'd seen Bone Crusher in the autumn. He'd won the Tancred, which is the BMW, coming from basically last, and then he won the Derby, not quite so spectacularly, but I'm sure he'd been flattened after the Tancred, and he was this super horse. And then, of course, the New Zealanders were telling us there was one that was just as good, and the build-up was phenomenal, and then the race itself was just remarkable, and... funny, Brian, because I called it, and I don't know. I think I did a reasonable job, and then I heard Bill's call afterwards, and I thought, oh God, you know, races into equine immortality, and the big red, and Bill's breathlessness, I think, up the straight, was actually so apt, because the horses were as tired. Bill was as tired as the horses, but it added to the theatre, didn't it?
Yeah, well, they were wobbling. The horses were wobbling. They were so tired. They'd taken off at the 800-metre mark, and his voice was starting to quiver too, but it was just... And it's all about the right line at the right time, and that's what it was. He delivered it, and that's the beauty of you as a broadcaster, the right line.
And I guess you search for it sometimes, and sometimes it comes out and sometimes it doesn't. But it was an amazing race. It was, I don't know. I mean, you see so many, and you've got to be careful. You don't. You've got to be balanced when you're a broadcaster over the years. And looking back now, of all the races I've seen, I mean, it's on the first page. I'm not sure how many I've got on that first page, but that Bone Crusher Waverley Star. For you, what about for you? For me, it's in the top half a dozen races I've ever seen, I think.
No doubt. I wasn't calling because I was at 3DB and Bill was calling, and I stood on that little lawn mound just probably a couple of strides past the post, and I watched them nearly head on up the straight. And I'd never seen anything like it, the way the race unfolded. But the confusion and mayhem and the euphoria all around the mounting yard and in the crowd, look... We couldn't believe what we just witnessed. It was extraordinary.
It was. The Cox Plate has an amphitheatre. I mean, you've been a huge part of the promotion of it over the years. And, the Maccabi Diva tsunami wave before the home.
Oh, yeah.
There's a million of them, but they all have a life of their own. But of all of them, we've mentioned Kingston Town and Bone Crusher. Those two Cox Plates and the Divas, I think, are... amongst the half a dozen great ones. Tobin Bronze sort of farewell. The Gunston was a remarkable day. Tullock before my time. But all of those races are remarkable events in Australian sport, I think.
Not a doubt. We're going for a break. Bruce McAvaney joining us this Racing Life. We're back with Bruce McAvaney. Bruce, the move from Channel 10, you went to Channel 10 in Melbourne 83, and then you were wooed across back to the 7 Network, because you'd been with the 7 Network in Adelaide, but back to 7 in November 1989. And so much sort of came your way, the Barcelona Games, the Grand Final, the AFL Grand Final, the TUI's 1000 Motor Racing, the Australian Open in tennis, the Masters Golf. The list is just endless. What a wonderful opportunity for a broadcaster who wanted to do it all.
Look, I've been lucky, Brian, really lucky. And most of it's, the only moves I've ever made in my career have been around the Olympics. When I think back now, talking today to you about it. So I left Adelaide for the Olympics, and I went from 10 back to 7 for the Olympics. So they're the only two really big moves I've made. So, and that was the reason behind the shift. And to go to 7 at that time, as you've just pointed out, I was given huge opportunities. At the right time of my life, you know, I was probably the right age and had enough experience. And, I was fortunate.
Carl Lewis and Ben Johnson, 100 metres, 1988. Where does that sit?
Yeah, right up there. In the year before, at the World Championships in Rome, Lewis had been the champion sprinter, but Johnson beat him and broke the world record. It was an incredible race. And then, of course, again, we were talking about a build-up to a Cox Plate. Well, the build-up to that race in Seoul was pretty remarkable. Johnson looked a bit unbeatable. And then very, very late in the season, before the Seoul Olympics, he'd been beaten twice. And he was going through a sort of a Usain Bolt unbeatable period. And suddenly the whole world changed. And so he went to Seoul under a bit of a cloud. And that cloud turned into a nightmare, as it turned out. But in the semi-final, he broke in the semi-final, Johnson. We thought he might, you could break twice and you're out. So he was under pressure in the semi. And in the semi, Lewis was more impressive. And then in the final, Johnson blew them away. But it was, with the aftermath, it's probably added to the legend. But it's probably singularly, I think, the biggest single event in Olympic history in terms of the build-up, the race, and the repercussions from it. So it was massive. And two guys didn't like each other, were so different. US versus Canada, and at the time, two giants in their sport. So, yeah, it's right up there.
So where does Usain Bolt, where does he sit, you know, with the Lewis and the Ben Johnson, the Michael Johnson, the Maurice Greene? Where would you have him? Who sits at the top of the pecking order?
Gee, that's a good question. Lewis has got two jewels in the crown. He won four gold medals at one Olympics, like Jesse Owens. So they're the only two to have done that in track and field for men. So that's one of his jewels. And the other one, and that was in 1984. So he won the 100, the 200, the long jump, and the 4x100. So that was that. And then he won the one event four times, the long jump in 84, 88, 92, 96. So he's got two diamonds. Now, there's only one other athlete that's done that, male athlete. So he's in rare air. But Bolt has the only man to have won the 200 twice, the only man to have won the 100, 200 twice. I think Bolt's the best I've seen. He's just got something extra, I think. Michael Johnson, incredible. Those other guys you've mentioned. But I think Bolt is singularly the best I've seen. I didn't think I'd see one better than Lewis, but I think I have. And in Rio next year, and he's no good thing, Brian. He's probably, if you're framing a market, I reckon he's probably about a $2.80 chance to win the 100, to be honest, because he's getting older and there's a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm being generous, but if he wins the 100 in Rio, he would have won the 100 metres at three Olympics, which no one's ever done, and I didn't think was imaginable. So I think he's the best, with or without Rio. Lewis is a short half head away in second place, and then there's a whole group of them. And we haven't mentioned the distance runners, but I'd have Bolt a short half head in front of Lewis.
Can they go quicker than 9.63 for 100 metres, do you think?
Look, Bolt thinks he can. His big thing he thinks he might be able to do is break 19 seconds for 200. He's run 19.19. The 100, I think his absolute fastest running is behind him. I don't think he's going to get down to the low 9.5s. I think he's going to probably, if he wins the Olympic final in Rio, I think it's going to be around about 9.7. But I think at 200, he still might be able to get close to that 19-second mark. So, yeah, no, I think it'll be, I don't think Usain will run any faster at 100 metres than he has now. I think that'll be the next champion in 20 years' time.
Interesting. Cathy Freeman, the Olympics 2000, what a moment that was. The build-up, we expected her to win, but she had to go there on the night and deliver it. How did you handle that? Because, this is the Olympics. It's in our country. It's 2000. The country's on show worldwide, globally, and our girl is poised to win the gold.
It's the closest thing, I think, in athletics that I've got to the pressure of that night, Brian, is when you called a Melbourne Cup. You know what it's like. I mean, the Melbourne Cup is a different event. It's a different beast. It's so nerve-wracking, and it's relief at the end of it when you're finished. I mean, oh, yes. And then the joy might come later, isn't it? But so that night with Freeman was interesting because it was, you know, well into the... It was about the fourth night of athletics, and I'd been working for, you know, a week and a half on the games, hosting and calling. But I remember on that very morning, that Monday morning, waking up, and I felt nervous, and I was doing interviews that day. And then on the night, there were some big events and some great events, and then I was going along... And then suddenly they came out for her race and my mouth got really dry. And I could remember saying to myself, you know, just relax. You've done your homework. Just enjoy it. And mm-hmm. I sort of pulled myself together on air. And then, you know, the call happens. But it was different. And I did feel the pressure that night. I mean, she carried a nation on her back. My yes. pressure was nothing compared with hers. Because what made that event so remarkable, I think, was this. You know, Kathy had lost one race in 4 years, and that was when she was injured. And she'd been a double world champion, and she'd been an Olympic silver medalist, but that counted for nothing had she lost that race. Her legacy was defined in a minute, and her, it was like she was walking a tightrope from one place to another in 49 seconds, and then she didn't survive, then her career was diminished. So her whole career was revolving around that one night, and she had to rise to the occasion, and she did quite magnificently. So it was a remarkable evening where so much depended on that one bit of, you know, courage and skill and ability from her, and so that's what happened.
Turning to back to racing, the Seven coverages in the last couple of years, particularly the Spring Carnival, just seems to have gone to another level. The, you know, the inclusion of Francesca and Simon Marshall doing different work, and Richard Friedman being there, but other people added to it. And I know you covered the Golden Slipper last week through Seven, and you hosted that, of course. We've got today the championships, the next 2 weeks the championships. How will you fit that in with AFL, which is about to kick off into next week?
Look, it's a balance, and it's tricky, Ben, but these are probably the busiest couple of weeks coming up because the footy does kick in. So Easter weekend's difficult because of all the footy. I've got a couple of footy matches plus the championships. We've got the Good Friday Appeal. So it's one of those, you know, I just have to get it done, and I get help, and I'm organised. But it's I feel you get... You know, it's exciting. It's great. But it's funny, the most relaxed you are when you're actually on air for those night days, because the stress of the prep is harder than the stress of the performance. It's quite a strange thing. And here I am at nearly 62 years of age and having done it for a long time, but yet it still doesn't get easier, but it's still just as rewarding. So it's just been well organised. But these couple of weeks that you just talked about, they're about the busiest I get for the whole year in terms of having to organise myself and prepare myself. So, yeah. But it's not like I'm not enjoying what I'm doing, because I love what I'm doing. But so it's a bit of a challenge, but it's fun in the end.
And Bruce, when you're sitting there at the host set for Channel 7 and you see Maccabi Diva about to create history, dashing to the front. She had radar. There was something about her to win her third Melbourne Cup, to create history. Does the caller come out in you? Because I know if I'm not calling, and I might be somewhere, you know, I was there for Black Caviar at Royal Ascot, and I sort of find myself sort of getting into the rhythm and the role of the call and the last, what I might have said. Do you find that at all?
A bit of that, for sure. On those big days, for sure. On those occasions, definitely. But it's not like I'm... missing it or envious, but you can't help it. It's instinctive. It's something that, and yeah, look, so it's never leaves us, never will. I mean, you know, I would think that if you could, you know, when I'm gone and finished and you don't have headstones, either, but if I had a headstone, I would like almost, I reckon, you know, whatever, one, describe my... working life, race caller would do me. And, you know, I'd be happy with that.
Would you?
It's a funny thing. It's instinctive, and I can understand. You know, for you with Black Caviar those days, and you've hit on a, you know, something that is so true. But like you, once you've been a race caller, always a race caller.
Yes.
No matter whether you're working at it or not, it never, ever leaves you. And I don't know about you, but I take a particular interest in the young ones coming up. I think you do.
Yes.
And you know, you're analysing them and you're thinking how good or how much improvement there might be. So, yeah, once a race caller, always a race caller.
It's probably a good note to end on too. You've given so much enjoyment and brought so much enjoyment to viewers, to listeners, right around, not just around Australia, but around the world. And, you know, you talk about what goes on your headstone. I'm not too sure what would go on your headstone. I don't think there'd be enough room because you've achieved so much. And it's the passion. And you only get by if you've got the passion and the desire and the love for what you do. And you do it so brilliantly. We've really enjoyed you sharing your calling career and your moments through racing, but right across a fabulous career this morning, Bruce.
Been my pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you. Bruce McAvaney, a legend in sports broadcasting.